has permission from Venerable Ajahn Anand, from the senior monks and the other monks, and to everyone gathered here to say a few words on Dhamma on this occasion of the Wat Mop Chan meditation retreat. So firstly, it's good to see everyone. I think I can recognize a few faces, happily smiling, happily meditating there. So glad I can have the opportunity today to give you a bit of encouragement in your practice in the Dhamma. So I guess we start by reflecting on this great opportunity that we have here, that we can all come together like this to learn Dhamma, to develop our minds, to give interest in Dhamma practice. We can see that this is a time of uncertainty. We can see there's many people in Wat Mop Chan, and I think it's just about maybe 200 kilometers or so away. There's fighting, a war, a shooting and bombing happening over there. Or in Venerable Ajahn Chah's monastery, Wat Nongpa Phong, is in the Ubon Ratchathani province, and that's right next to the border. And so with all this uncertainty, it's a reminder for us to be heedful and diligent in our practice. Life is uncertain, and the time that is good and conducive for practice is impermanent. And so now is a good time that we have, and we should make good use of. And I can remember reading a story of Ajahn Chah when he was at Wat Nongpa Phong. And back then there was a threat of communists coming to take over the country or the place, the district. And the disciples were worried and asking, Longpa, if the communists come, where will you go? And apparently Ajahn Chah said, where is there to go? Communists have been there since we've been born. And so in terms of the Dhamma, we've been born and we face aging, sickness and death. So Ajahn Chah asked us, where else can we go? So in other words, we have had death ever since the moment we've been born. And so we're to be right here and to deal with it right here. And recently happened to read another story about Venerable Ajahn Mun, who we know is the founder of the Thai forest tradition. And at the time he was residing in the forest. And I think another monk wrote this, but it was that a protective deity of Thailand had come to visit and shared the news that around that time, it was around World War II, and there was heavy bombing around Bangkok. And Venerable Ajahn Mun asked if there was any casualties there to this dewa, and the group had come. And the dewa said that there were casualties. And Ajahn Mun asked them, why aren't you protecting them? And they said that they couldn't protect the ones who had a heavy karma that they owed to the enemy, but they could only protect those who don't have that karma, and protecting the sites that are very important Buddhist sites. And so they requested a gatha. It's like a meditation or maybe a mantra or a verse that could give protection to bombs and from affecting sort of these important places. And apparently after thinking about it, Venerable Ajahn Mun gave them a gatha, and that was this verse that we chant. It's Namo Vimuttanang, Namo Vimuttiya. And it means homage to the liberated ones, homage to liberation. And this gatha, this verse, it's part of one of the protective verses that the monks would chant, called the Mora Parita. And this was coming from one of the Jatakas, which is supposed to be one of the past life stories of the Buddha, of our Buddha. And so in this life, the Buddha was born as a golden peacock. And in the morning, before he would leave to go out to find food to eat, he would chant this protective verse, this Mora Purita, where he would give homage to the sun and to the learned ones, to the Buddhas and their enlightenment, and to the liberated ones and to liberation. And he would again chant this verse upon coming back to the nest and to before resting at night. And so it said it happened one day that this queen of that kingdom had a dream of this golden peacock and wanted it to see it for herself. So she told this to the king, and the king sent this expert hunter to catch that golden peacock alive. But no matter what traps that hunter set out, the traps would never go off and the peacock would always be safe. And so after 7 years, and he returned and told the king and queen, and angry at this, the king spread it before he died that whoever eats this golden peacock will gain immortal life. And so the next 5 kings in succession, they tried to send hunters to catch this peacock, but they all failed. And so it was only after the 7th king, who had sent an intelligent hunter out to catch the peacock, but instead of setting traps, then this hunter had trained a peahen, so a female peacock, who could sing very beautifully and who could dance very beautifully. And the hunter let this peahen loose very early in the morning before the peacock had chanted his protective verses. And when the peacock heard this beautiful singing, he was enchanted by it and left his nest in search of that singing. And then he saw the peahen dancing very beautifully. And so this peacock was easily caught by the hunter. And the end of this story is that after being brought back to the king, the peacock told of how the golden skin was because of the 5 precepts, keeping that in a previous life, and so was let free. So this story emphasizes, or maybe is a bit of a moral of this story, is that to be safe, maybe it's not good enough just to pay homage to the liberated ones, to liberation, to do the chants, but we also need to restrain and to abandon our desire, craving, attachment, greed, and lust. And if we can do that, then we'll be safe. We'll be safe inside with our mindfulness and wisdom. So Venerable Ajahn Anand would often give the teaching of Lumpur Dul, who's a famous teacher in Thailand. And one of his teachings is that samudaya, the cause of suffering, is sending the mind out. Marga, which is the path to ending suffering, is keeping the mind in. And so when we can bring up these skillful qualities and intentions and become established in them, then we can be safe. We're safe from all the unskillful and harmful qualities and states of mind. We're safe from suffering. And when we're safe from unskillful states of mind, then we won't do anything unskillful in terms of our actions, speech, and thoughts. And then we can be free from the suffering or the results from coming from unskillfulness. Someone asked me recently, what was the first Dhamma teaching that really went deep for me? And I said it was when a monk asked me very early on, when I was a layperson, what is the highest wealth? And back then I couldn't answer that question. And the man who's asked me this question, he said, oh, maybe it's money or gold. And the answer was contentment. No matter how much wealth or things we have, if there's still a desire for more, then you can't be called wealthy. So having this contentment or non-greed, being satisfied with what we have, When we have this quality, then we are safe from greed, from desire, from wanting more, from dissatisfaction with what we have. And also someone like this, whether they have a little or a lot, then they'll be fine, they'll be safe, and they won't suffer. In other words, they have wisdom along with what they have. And they'll also naturally have this heart, which we call chaga. Chaga is a heart that's happy to give, that is very liberal, freely giving, charitable. They're able to easily abandon things. They're not selfish. And they also find joy and happiness in this quality of giving and charity and this sort of expansive state of mind. And this is one who also then is able to start walking this path. And this is kind of also the first step on the ladder of letting go. As in, we need to have this as our foundation. And so this sort of non-greed or contentment also applies to our meditation practice as well. Apparently, there was one Westerner who said to Ajahn Chah that I like samadhi, concentration, and I want the mind to be quiet. And that's a fair enough want, or that you want the mind to be peaceful and quiet. And so Ajahn Chah said, it's true that you want this, but all things arise from causes. Saying that is like we only want the results. And Ajahn Chah compared it to eating a watermelon. He said, like, we eat a watermelon and we know that, oh, it's nice and it's red and it's very tasty. We eat it and it's very sweet. He said, but that's all we know. We don't know at all how to grow watermelons, where they come from. We got no idea. And so practicing here, you're trying to learn and to develop the causes of how to gain that peaceful mind, leading to true understanding. And this requires us to put in effort, to be diligent in those causes, in the what will bring up peace. And we also have to know how to abandon the causes which are going to obstruct and stop peace from arising. And so we can build and be content with gradually and slowly increasing and growing our mindfulness, being more consistent in the practice, being growing our awareness, the knowing more and more. Or at other times, maybe people are putting in too much sort of expectations and they're really going for it. And so Ajahn Chah gave an example of someone who's lighting an incense stick, and then they say that they won't move or they won't get up until this incense stick is all burnt out. And then they get a lot of pain, and then so they open up their eyes, and then they see, oh, there's still a lot left. And then they make another determination to sit. Then the pain, they can't bear it anymore. They open up their eyes again, and they thought, oh, it should be finished by now, but there's still a lot left. Then they give up, and they think, oh, they're hopeless, they can't do it, and they blame themselves, and they think they made a lot of bad karma. And so we're taught to stay with it consistently. We have to know ourselves, be content with ourselves, with the level and the strength that we have, and we try to build slowly more and more on that. If we want it to be like that person, or we compare ourselves with this other person, and we want it quick like that, then we just make ourselves suffer for no reason. So the next quality that we have to be established in is metta, goodwill, loving kindness. And I think recently Venerable Ajahn Anand gave a talk about the dangers and drawbacks of fault finding, that it is able to be an obstruction to your practice. And so if we're able to be established in metta, the heart having this metta, goodwill, then we'll be safe from ill will, from hate, from intentions to harm, safe from irritation, anxiety, frustrations, safe from fault finding, blaming, and insulting. I remember once I was at Wat Mab Chan early on, and all of us were very determined to practice. And especially in the Vasa, the rains retreat, Ajahn Anand would have us practice more strictly and to take on these austere practices more during this period of time, like staying up all night on a more sort of regular and basis, continuous basis. And at that time, there was this young samanera, this little novice boy, and he was staying there in Wat Mab Chan as well, and he wasn't serious at all. He'd play and joke around and run around and couldn't keep still. I remember being irritated or even angry at him. Why was he here? He's not even serious about practice. You know, he's just playing around all day. And the mind was sort of going like this. And so brought up the recollection of death and thinking, oh, what if I was to die today? Would I be angry at him? Would I be irritated? And this recollection went in deeply, and this profound sort of metta came up, and all the ill will that I've been holding on to just dropped away. Any sort of thinking over and over about it all dropped away. And when I saw this novice again, I thought, oh, he's so cute. Had a big smile and a heart of metta towards this little novice. And to others as well. And so being established in metta, in goodwill, as Ajahn Anand says, then this will be a foundation for our concentration and samadhi to arise. So we're clearing away this hindrance of ill will and disliking, aversion from the mind. Then that becomes a basis for peace to arise. And we need to have wisdom as well. This wisdom is like a clear knowing. There's a clear knowing of what is right and wrong, what is good and bad, what is of benefit and harm, what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. If we are established in this, then we're safe. We're safe from delusion, the things that are trying to trick us, to get us to think in certain ways and to do things that are of no sort of benefit and harm, and that are harmful to us. Like these days in Thailand, there's a bit of sort of bad news about monks in Thailand, and maybe of this and that monk doing things inappropriately. And some of the Buddhist people, maybe they've been long-term Buddhists, and they see it, and they some of them lose faith. They think, oh, if it's like that, better not be Buddhist at all, or why give, or, you know, there's no more good monks. And sort of this type of thinking and views is not wise. It's not having wisdom. You know, this power of the Sangha is such that the monks that don't follow the sila, you know, the precepts, the rules, they sort of naturally get washed away. It's compared to like the great ocean that washes away a dead body to the shore. But what we do have to worry about is when this fake Dhamma or the fake teachings come and take over the real teachings. In other words, people start taking and practicing by these teachings that aren't the real teachings or the true teachings, the true Dhamma. And it's compared to like when the fake gold enters the market and then the real gold disappears. So this means that we have to have this confidence and faith in the Buddha. His enlightenment was real, and that he taught the Dhamma Vinaya, which is the way to be liberated from all dukkha, from suffering, and that there really was the Arya Sangha, the noble ones who heard those teachings, they practiced them, and they truly followed and gained liberation from suffering. And so we have this faith and confidence in this. And we ourselves know about the Dhamma, we're sincere in our practice of this true Dhamma, and that we are sure that when we keep walking on this path, then we will see and know the Dhamma, we will get to the goal. And so this is bringing in the practice more inside, more and more. This is where the Dhamma is opanayiko, which is leading inwards. And so we're bringing up wisdom with our practice. And, you know, maybe we're practicing and meditating, maybe in the monastery or at home, and there are things that are bothering us, maybe the sounds around us or circumstances have arisen, or maybe some pain coming up, things not going the way we want it to. And so Ajahn Chah gave that example that maybe you've heard already during this retreat, but which is that we may hear this sound and we think the sound is bothering us, and then we suffer. But Ajahn Chah said, if we investigate it deeper, then it's us, it's we who go bothering the sound. The sound is simply sound. And if we understand it like this, then there's nothing more to be done. We're leaving the sound as it is. The sound is just one thing. The mind is another thing. We don't go grabbing on to that sound, to that thing. And this is like we are knowing the truth, or we have wisdom there. And like this, then we're peaceful. We don't have a desire there to want it to be this or that way. And our wisdom then arises, or we have wisdom established well. So when we're established with these qualities of having contentment, metta, goodwill, and wisdom and understanding, then already our sila, our precepts, our morality and virtue is already well established. And like this, we're very safe from any unskillful or bad conduct in body, speech, and mind. And like this, the mind is free from any sort of bad feelings or remorse, or and it's like there's a joy and happiness that comes up from this skillful qualities that we've developed. And this is then a foundation for our peace and samadhi to arise. It leads to it naturally. There was once in Wat Mapchan when there was a new monk who was sweeping the compound, and he was sweeping sort of quite unhappily because at that time there was a lot of haze, you know, haze from these forest fires and bad air pollution around the area in Wat Mapchan. And so Anand was walking and I was with him, and he goes up to this monk who looked unhappy and asked him, if there's a lot of haze, is that suffering and is it dangerous to your health? And the monk said, yes. And then Ajahn Anand said, so what to do then? Do you stay in your kuti, your hut, close all the windows, and then turn on the aircon or the air filter? And then the monk said, yes. And then if it rains, then is it good? I said, oh, yes, then the haze will go away. The air will be good again. Ajahn Anand said, oh, it's the same with the mind. When there is the greed, anger, delusion, then it's as if there's a haze that is temporarily overcoming the mind. And the more it stays, the more dangerous it is. So you need to go to your kuti and to use butto or another mantra or meditation object, and to shut all the windows, which is the sense doors, And then the rain will come in, the rain will come, and then the haze will go away. And so this is a teaching that Ajahn Anand gave to that new monk. And it's kind of what we're doing and practicing. You've been given instructions of how to develop your meditation object, whether that's butto, dhammo, sangho, whether you're sitting, standing, walking, lying down, and whatever activities you're doing, or it's the breath along with butto. Or those who think a lot may have been advised to use sort of contemplation and reflections in order to bring the mind to more peace. And so we're developing this in our practice. And it does take some sort of time to practice with it in a more continuous way. Recently we had a woman come and she's been practicing more than 30 years. And over this rains retreat, she'd been practicing more continuously, and she was doing more walking meditation. And she came and said, "Oh, finally, after hearing these Kuba Ajahns, the teachers, teach so much about being mindful of the breath, and then using the meditation word, and then it disappears. Then the breath becomes coarse itself, and it feels like it disappears from awareness. And one's awareness becomes a lot more prominent, refined, and then there's peace and concentration arising." And she said she finally got to understand this more. After 30 years, she said she'd been doing it, and now really getting the results of it. And she said, "Oh, the teachers were teaching this all along, but only now I've sort of glimpsed it or really got to understand it." Then she'd bring the mind to contemplate the body. And so we trying to make the mind or our practice more continuous, more all-rounded. Like one of the teachings that Venerable Ajahn Mun gave to Venerable Ajahn Chah, which is making our practice to be more like a circle. And a circle never ends. It just keeps going round and round. And this is like our practice that goes continually without stopping. And so this is the awareness that we're trying to make more and more continuous. And another simile Ajahn Chah uses, the water that you're pouring out from the kettle, that you tilt it a little bit and there's just a drop, water, drop after a long time, another drop. But if you tilt it more and more, then the drops become more frequent. There's less gaps between it. And more you tilt it, then the water flows and becomes a stream. And this stream of water, he said, comes from the drops of water. And this water is meaning our awareness, our mindfulness. If we can make it more continuous, all-rounded, then our mindfulness becomes more present. And it can be like that maybe by day and night. This is like a knowing, and anything that we need sort of to bring up or to abandon, then we will know, because that awareness is always there. And so he said that awareness is will be like a circle, and the circle is the shape of our practice. So practicing with effort like this is called wakefulness. Wakefulness is one of the three practices that the Buddha said is never wrong. The second practice is moderation in eating. And so not eating for desires and likes, but eating in a way that you're just looking after the body. The Buddha compared it to like a wound of ours that we just need to look after. And so we're doing it to rid off sort of painful feelings from hunger, and we're able to use our bodies then to keep going in the practice. The third practice that is never wrong is sense restraint. And so whenever we experience sense contact, what we see, hear, touch, taste, feel, we think all these moods in the mind, we tend to grasp onto, we just want to focus or catch on to those beautiful and pleasing aspects of that sense object. And so then desire, liking comes up for it, and we get lost in it. On the other side, we grasp the unbeautiful, unpleasant things of something, and we have aversion, wanting to push it away. And so we need to be more restrained in our sense contact, more careful about it. And especially practicing on a retreat, then you really get to see the importance of sense restraint. That will help you to sort of improve your practice, your mindfulness, and improve your peace that you're developing. So Ajahn Chah said it's like someone who's living in the city, they don't see the dangers of the forest. But someone who goes in the forest, then they'll be more aware to the dangers of the forest, like maybe wild animals or you know, dangerous places. And for samadhi, for our development of concentration, then the danger is these sense objects. So we firstly practicing to reduce the amount we receive until we can develop our minds to be strong enough to develop wisdom from them. In other words, maybe the defilements are too strong, the habits are too strong, and so we need to reduce our sense contact, have more mindfulness with it, and until we're strong enough to build more sort of samadhi and peace, and then we can come back to contemplate these sense objects and to gain wisdom. So one simile that Ajahn Chah used was the one room which has the six doors in this room, and there's only one chair in the middle. And we're told that we have to sit on this one chair, and all the visitors coming through the doors, they will enter and they'll come to this chair and they'll find us sitting on it. That is, we have mindfulness, we have awareness there, and they'll find that there's nowhere to sit and they'll have to leave. And so all the visitors coming have to come to this one spot. And our job is just to bring up mindfulness and to stay on the chair. And so this is, I guess, one way this simile is used is that it's our bringing up of samadhi, of mindfulness. The other way it's used is that when we're sitting on this one chair, our awareness is constantly there, then we're able to see and know each sense object as it comes to the mind, and we get to know what it's like. It's like this, it's like that. And this is the contemplation or the understanding of the three characteristics of anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self, understanding this nature of all phenomena that's coming in. Now, we had one man who was practicing this, and he said, I can see more this arising of when we have this sense contact, and then there's a feeling, pleasurable, painful arising, and then I can see the mind getting caught up in that, and I let go, and then I can I have mindfulness with that, and I can let go of that, and I can see this arising and passing more, and how it doesn't have a sense of self in there. It's a very impermanent nature of these objects coming. And he asked, but it's kind of tiring that I have to go out and contemplate this. I have to find objects to contemplate, to bring up this wisdom or to understand about it. And this is where this teaching comes in of Ajahn Chah saying, if this is an important point, that you just have to stay in this one spot, because everything is going to come to you, to this one spot. And from there, if your awareness is there, is present, is unbroken, then you'll get to see and understand it clearly for what it is, the sort of understanding of its true nature. And so you hear the teaching Ajahn Anand will give of make the mind peaceful. And if the mind can become peaceful and it may emerge from that peace, then the thoughts may come up and one has that samadhi there and can see the thought arising and passing, and then wisdom can arise from that. That's just like what this sort of simile is pointing to, and that can lead to seeing the Dhamma. And so these sense objects, the sense experiences of ours, is a very important point we need to get to understand. It's because right now when we sort of have a wrong view towards these sense experiences, sense objects, we think it has a lot of happiness and only a little bit of suffering, only a little bit of danger and drawbacks. But the Buddha's view is opposite. It's like sense objects, sense experiences have a lot of suffering, a little bit, a tiny bit of happiness, and a lot of danger and drawbacks. And the Buddha gave similes to for us to sort of picture and to understand more of what the Buddha was talking about. So there's the first simile is that there's a hungry dog, and the dog is waiting outside the sort of butcher shop, and the butcher throws them a bone, but this bone has no flesh on it or no meat on it whatsoever, purely just blood and fleshless. And so they give the bone to the dog, and then the dog can't get full because it's got no meat. And eventually the dog gets weary and frustrated. And so it's kind of like that with sense objects. There's that much happiness in it. It's like a bone there, and it never is filling. We never get full from our sense experiences, pleasures, whatever it is. The second simile is that it's like a vulture takes a piece of meat in his beak and then flies away, and then all these other vultures and crows and hawks come to try to take the meat by pecking this bird. And if the bird does not let this meat go, like drop it, then he'll experience a lot of suffering or even die from this. And so he has to drop it. This is like, you can see the competitive nature and all this of competing for sort of sense pleasures. There's just competing, there's just sort of fighting, which we can see all over the place. The third simile is like a grass torch, they say. Maybe back in the old days, you have those grass torches, you burn them and you carry it with a stick, and the person walks against the wind. So he's walking against the wind, and this fire is going to burn his hand or his face or other parts of his body. And so if he doesn't quickly let this go, then he'll get burnt. And so this sort of maybe referring to what happens when you attach and hold on to anything, then it's going to cause you suffering, right? It's holding on to this torch. The fourth simile is that there's a pit of glowing coals, and these coals are very deep, and this person who doesn't want to suffer gets caught by two big men and dragged to this pit of coals. And this is maybe like the suffering waiting up ahead. Like we know now, then we have this body, you know, up ahead. The teachers say there's just suffering waiting up ahead, all this aging, sickness and death. And so this person then would struggle because he knows he's going into this pits of coals, so quickly try to struggle and get away from them. The fifth one is that this person has a dream, and he dreams of all these delightful parks, meadows, lotus ponds, and then later he wakes up and just realizes it's just a dream. And there's nothing really there at all. And so maybe this is pointing to the sort of how there's no true substance to all these, you know, sense pleasures there. It's like a dream we had. You know, can you remember the time that you had all these pleasures back before? You know, where are they now? And just like a dream and already gone. The next simile is like this man who has borrowed some goods. And if we put it in today's terms, it's like they borrow a sports car and maybe some nice, a lot of jewelry, a watch, a really expensive watch. And then he goes and shows off to everyone, parades it himself. And then the people there say, oh, this is how wealthy people are. This is exactly how it is when you're wealthy. But then the owners of those goods see them and they take back what is theirs. And then that person who gets his belongings taken back, he starts becoming upset at that and just say, oh, that's enough. And this one is maybe compared to the teacher saying, these things that we have are borrowed. Our body here is given to us or lent to us by nature. Whenever it wants to take it back, it takes it back. It never asked for permission because it's not really ours. And the last simile given is like a person who goes into this forest and he's looking for fruit and he sees a tree, none of the fruit have fallen. So he goes up the tree and tries to pick up the fruit, and he's going to pick up the fruit and going to take some back with him. Then another person comes along and he also wants fruit. And so he looks up and says, oh, I don't know how to climb trees, so I'm going to get an axe. And he's getting the axe to cut it, this tree down. And so the person up there, if he doesn't quickly come down, then this tree is going to fall down and he's going to maybe die or get into a lot of suffering. This is maybe like how our time is getting less and less. While we're picking fruits up, getting a little bit of happiness here and there, this tree is going to be chopped down. And if we don't quickly do something about it, get out of the tree, then we're going to suffer. So in all these similes, it's not just showing of how much sort of suffering that there really is with all these sense pleasures, the sense objects, but of what we're meant to do as well. In all of them, there's of letting go, as in they drop that. There's a dropping of the bone, the dropping of the meat that the bird takes away. There's a dropping of the torch that's burning, trying to escape from that pit of coals. Sort of seeing the dream is not much, there's nothing to it. And the borrowed goods, he's become sick of borrowing goods. And the last one is that he quickly gets out of the tree. So all of this is pointing towards that sort of all these sense experience of ours is something that brings up desire. When we have desire towards them, then that leads us to suffer because these things are inherently impermanent. They're unsatisfactory and they can never have any self to it. We can never really call it ours. And so if we truly see with wisdom, with understanding that these things are truly hot and burning all over, there's no way that we can touch it that's cool, then the dispassion arises, the disenchantment, we give up our desire, clinging or wanting to any of it, and it's cool and peaceful right there. And that's where we can meet with the end of suffering, because the desire, the cause of suffering, has been abandoned. We can say that this is where it's truly safe, just like the peacock who can be safe without, if he can abandon the desire, the craving, the attachment, then and not bringing up the cause of suffering, which is going outside. All that has been abandoned and cut off. So I give this for reflections for today. Encourage you to, in the time and the few days that are left of the retreat, that you put in effort, determination, and that after the retreat ends, that you may be able to continue and maintain your practice, making more the practice more and more like that circle of awareness that we're trying to develop. Rejoice with all your goodness and all your practice. May all your wholesome aspirations meet with success.
Thank you so much, Ajahn, for your discourse. I have a question regarding how to keep the practice at home, how to restrain the sense doors when there are a lot of distractions, and I may not have a Theravada Buddhist environment or community near me, and how can I practice according to what you said when I'm at home and keep up with the vigor and the pace and keep with the mindfulness. Thank you.
Sense reducing first the amount of sort of sense contact you have would be the first way. Maybe that means, you know, where does the mind go out to when you go home? You know, is there sort of doors that you need to reduce? Maybe reducing news or reducing certain things. We have a woman who joins our online chanting, and so we do chanting at 7 o'clock, and she will sort of, she has duties at home, so she'll prepare dinner, everything for the family, etc. And then at a bit before seven, she will sort of cut everything off. No more, her responsibilities are done. Goes into her meditation or altar room, closes the door, join the chanting, do a meditation, and I think practice a bit after that. And everyone in the house knows that that's her time. She turns off her phone, all this off, and that's her time to practice. And so you still have to fulfill your responsibilities and duties at home, but you can appropriately manage your situation at home. And it's, if you have that firm intent, then you know you can do it. And if you maybe can't do that so much, then you have to have a lot of mindfulness with those sort of sense contact you have. So yeah, maybe joining a online community as well seems to help people like this, right? At this time you're practicing.